Support for KMUW's Into Music podcast comes from McClelland, reminding listeners that Frank Sinatra coined the word skibbity in Strangers in the Night, which you can listen to in their downtown Wichita showroom. More info on McClelland's innovative sound, lighting, and video technology can be found at maxsound.com.
Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guest on this episode is Joshua Ackley of the band The Dead Bettys. The band recently took a pause in making an upcoming double record to issue the new EP Whitey, which is out November 21st on Rotten Princess Records. The collection finds the trio sounding vital and hungry, eager to continue blazing new sonic paths as they've done since forming in the early 2000s. Ackley recently discussed the making of the EP, Whitey, the themes behind its title track, and the connection between horror films and queer culture. That's Joshua Ackley of The Dead Bettys on Into Music, coming up now. What was kind of the inspiration for this EP? Was it just like, this is the time in the band's cycle to make something new? Or was it like, oh man, we've got these songs and we really want to get in and record them?
I think it's twofold. I think, yes, we had these songs, just a few of them, like two of them really necessarily that we were like, we should just record these. These are great. At the same time, we're working on a double album. And that's pretty like strict and it's concept driven. And so a lot of the time, just like recording and then throwing out and recording and throwing out. And so I think we just got a little like antsy. And then following, of course, the political upheaval, whatever you want to call what's going on globally in the world right now, you know, it just felt kind of like if you're in a rock band, you know, if you have any sort of merit, like right now, you should just be putting music out. You know, now's the time to create. Like, that's the best antidote for any sort of problem. And so we decided, you know, while we're doing this double album, you know, when the moment strikes, let's just record EPs. Just for fun and get them out and make them as fiery and political as we want. So that's pretty much what happened. And one of the songs had been around for like a little bit and we never had a good recording of it. And it, the time made sense now.
I was like, wow, this is like blazing. This has got like this energy to it and so forth. So that was a very real thing in the band. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, we were signed to Warner early on, and we've spent a lot of the time in studios and a lot of the time in big studios. And it's always funny when you get a finished product that doesn't sound anything like your live sound. And so we've spent kind of a lot of time and money on our own studio in Long Island that we can record in, and we know we're going to sound like us. And so this EP was kind of, it's a little bit of the first true output that we're happy with that sounds like us live. And so that was really important. And we do play live a lot. We play live together, you know, so it's important for us to sound pretty raw.
Yeah. Well, that's awesome. And I have to ask about the Liz Phair cover, because I was like, oh, that's cool.
Yeah, the Liz Phair cover is pretty personal, actually. I'm from a tiny, tiny town in northwest New Mexico. New Mexico is wonderful. It's very blue. I happen to be from the deepest red pocket with a lot of fundamentalist Mormons and then also mainstream Mormons and a lot of oil field stuff going on. And so not the most open community. And I have very, very hippie liberal parents. And so they were cool with me being gay from a very young age. And so I was never really in the closet. And that made growing up there, specifically junior high, pretty much hell on earth. And my dad realized it and was kind of like, what the hell are we going to do? This kid needs music. And my parents always had music. They always had vinyls playing. And that album came at such a specifically important moment for me. I had to leave the eighth grade because it was just so hostile of an environment for me and transfer school districts. So I had like this 5 to 6 month summer break where I was just not in school. I had no friends. And the guys that my dad there was a store in our town called the CD Exchange, and they were just like skater, like stoner guys. And I think they realized like this kid needs good records. And so they basically prompted me to buy Exile in Guyville when it came out. And it was like having a big sister for that entire 6 month period where I was just kind of alone in my house, but at a good age where you can be alone in your house. And I just played that thing over and over and over. And Girls, Girls, Girls is such an underrated song.
Were you already playing music yourself at that point?
Yeah, we always had instruments in the house, even just to have around, right? I took violin growing up and also piano, but I was pretty rebellious. So I would always kind of be like, eh, screw classes, I'm going to do my own thing. But, you know, my brother drums, and he's always been very musically inclined. And so he would drum and I would pick up a guitar and we would just jam out. And so we were constantly playing music from a young age. And it was really, really important to my parents that we had points of view when it came to music. So we were always inclined.
Wow. That's amazing. So that sounds like just like a cool family to be part of. Did you recognize that at the time?
I recognized it in high school because I would have friends come over and parents aren't usually cool. But my dad would, you know, come in with a PJ Harvey record and be like, have you heard this new PJ Harvey album? And my friends would be like, you've got to be kidding me. Like, this is not planet Earth. Where do you live? Who are these people? And, you know, I would try to have like my own taste, and I do have my own taste, and they didn't really dictate what I had to listen to. But, you know, I would bring home like Madonna's Like a Prayer, and my mom specifically would make sure that every like Madonna album I bought, I had a Prince record and like a Donna Summer record and an Aretha Franklin record. Like, she did not want a house full of like specifically white pop artists. So they were very, very in tune with just not letting us kind of have like a siloed approach to our taste in music and culture specifically.
Were they artistic people? Is that where this was coming from? Or
yeah, I mean, they were always pretty wild. They were always pretty, you know, you don't move to rural New Mexico just on a whim. A lot of people probably move there the way my parents did, to kind of live off the earth and maybe be a bit off the grid, and maybe have a distaste for society. And so that's how they wound up there. That's how we wound up there. But, you know, my dad was in a mime troupe. He always did theater. He traveled with the mime troupe. And my mom's brother was in a pretty big bluegrass band, and she was just always around music. And her mom was very, very much into integration in the South and civil rights. And so they were always pretty active when it came to not only music, but like arts and culture, and making sure that we had a nuanced approach and understood all of that.
Wow. So this isn't something where it was like you were just waiting for something to happen and punk rock happened to be the thing. You had all this other stuff, and then somehow punk came into the picture.
Yeah, punk came. I didn't really. It's funny because I would never classify myself as punk. And in fact, when the Dead Betties first started out, and we were playing like CBGBs and ABC No Rio and just all of those, you know, like grittier Lower East Side clubs, and people used to actually kind of make fun of the way I dressed, because I've never really been specifically like traditionally punk. The drummer, certainly, yeah. Like, he's always, you know, he's had mohawks, like he's that guy. But for me, it was always more political, right? Like, I started getting the Kill Rock Stars mailing list in junior high and high school. So it was all of these like Heavens to Betsy, Bikini Kill, Sleater-Kinney records from the early days of those bands. And That's what really drew me in. You know, like, we would get into huge political debates in my house. And so it was kind of something that we were conditioned to do, and really kind of question everything and debate everything. And so when I heard those records, I was like, this is an open debate. Like, Bikini Kill is having an open debate on stage with their audience, basically. And that really drew me in, and it really turned me on. And then a lot of those records were so intelligent and so thought-provoking. And so I found punk, quote unquote punk, I found some of the radio punk to be pretty boring, but the punk with a message really stood out to me. And like going back to Madonna, I think she's kind of one of the most punk of them all. You know, go watch the Like a Prayer video. You know, in the Reagan 80s, when no one would talk about AIDS, this woman handed out condoms in her biggest album. And with a slip in the album telling people what AIDS was and what it wasn't. And then this video where the KKK rapes a woman and they like basically frame black people for it. And then you have Madonna dancing in front of a burning cross. I mean, that's pretty punk. You don't really see people even now taking those risks. And so the punk that I liked kind of really went there. I mean, I think a lot of people would really cringe at hearing me saying Madonna's punk, but like, you know, she really did things before people were allowed to do. Like Courtney Love has a lot to thank, you know, on behalf of Madonna.
Wow. See, this is thing that I think about a lot, where people are always talking about, you know, how, oh, punk rock was rejecting the hippies. And then it's true. But it's like, if you look at like the social element of it, like, I don't know, like Fugazi, Black Flag, they're the children of people who were social activists in the 60s. And they're taking that and bringing that into their musical community.
100%. And, you know, I think what happened, and, you know, my parents would rail against this too, because they would be like, well, there were real hippies and then there were just kind of like, you know, like cafeteria hippies, right? So like people who really liked the image and who really liked, you know, peace and love for a time. But then when it came expedient for them to grow up and to buy houses and move to the suburbs, you know, you see this like slow move to more conservatism, right? And so by the time Reagan came along, you had a lot of these people who were former hippies who were now like Republicans. And so, you know, you have this weird split screen of, you know, people like my parents who never went that direction. And then the kids of the parents who went the conservative direction, who were like, well, hippies must suck because you were hippies and now you're just these like complete square conservative people. I'm going punk and, you know, screw hippies. So it was probably beneficial. And I don't think I knew this until I was much older for me to have the parents I had, because I don't really hate hippies. And I do believe in, you know, reducing waste and like simple things that generation actually did teach me from a very young age, you know? And so I think what happens to any movement, you know, like I think about Nirvana fans a lot and I think about Rage Against the Machine fans a lot. And, you know, it's like a lot of the majority of those guys from the 90s don't really realize what they were singing about. And so now it's like, you know, you have like these Republican politicians being like, Nirvana is my favorite band. And you want to be like, they would hate you. You know, so I wonder right now if there's like a rejection of punk too, of like, you know, the 90s, of people being like, well, my parents suck and those are their favorite bands.
It's as we're talking about this, I'm reminded of this quote by Frank Zappa that the most dangerous substance known to man is LSD, because it can turn a hippie into a yuppie.
Indeed. And now we've got ketamine doing the same thing.
So I also am curious about this thing about if you were never in the closet with your parents, this is the inverse experience for so many kids. So when, and I'm imagining even back in small town New Mexico, you probably knew other kids who were in the closet. So what was that like when you realize that you had a different story than other people?
Part of being in a household where you're out, specifically with my parents, is their ethos was like, you never hide who you are. So I was out in school as well. And I think in junior high, it was different. So the town I'm from, the town we lived in, Kirtland, New Mexico, is tiny, tiny, tiny. I remember when it got a stoplight and it was like a ribbon cutting. But that was tough. Because I was probably 11 or 12, you know, there was a feeling I got that there were other people like me there, but it was so, you're talking about the peak of the AIDS crisis, like 1992, 1993, when people were just listening to Rush Limbaugh, and Rush Limbaugh was saying like, all gay people should die. This is exactly what should be happening. You know, if we could only move them to an island and nuke that island, you know, as a kid hearing that and then seeing people in your hometown treat you a certain way, you start to really absorb that and say like, wow, people, I am not wanted on this planet at all. That became a pretty dangerous situation for me. So I was pulled out of school. They brokered a deal to take me to a much better school district. in that school district where I went to high school, things were different. And there's a lot to be said about socioeconomics in that conversation, because this was a much wealthier high school. So people had manners and they weren't about to like bully me in public. There was definitely bullying, but it wasn't nearly at the scale that it was in my original school in the town I still lived in. But I managed to date openly in high school. I managed to actually have sex with dudes, which is wild. Not all of them were out of the closet. I think only a couple. And I don't think they were even fully out ever. I think they were just kind of like safely in between. And the 90s, that was a thing, kind of like it is now, where people were like, oh, I'm fooling around with bisexuality. So I had it both ways in a sense, but I don't regret either experience, because I have a really thick skin and I think I see political times like we're in now as through a much different lens than a lot of people. A lot of people think the sky is falling, and I'm sitting here being like, I've seen it worse. We just need to be responsible and get out of it. But to answer your question, it was post high school. I know a lot of guys who came out, and that's always very strange when you're a full-on adult and you're like, oh, that guy. Okay, wow. That girl. Okay, cool. Interesting. It would have been nice for them to pull me aside in high school and be like, don't tell anyone, but me too. Let's be friends. You know, that might have been nice.
Yeah, yeah. Well, but, you know, part of asking about that is because I feel like today, not that kids have it easier, but I feel like there's more understanding and acceptance. Even among their peers, obviously there's still some bullying, there's still some hatred, but it's a different landscape.
Yeah, it's a much different landscape. I mean, I do think it depends on where you live. You know, I think we unfortunately do live now in like media planet 2.0, where people are just so saturated with messages from corporations, essentially. I mean, social media is supposed to be authentic, and it's actually just this kind of like pit of advertisement and influence, where you're really seeing stories of like successful homosexuals living in wealthy cities and suburbs, right? And so that's a great story to see, and that's a very safe space to live. But I can only imagine what it's like for the states that have gone like nuclear red. I can only imagine what it's like for a kid in small town Mississippi or in Arizona. Or in, I mean, just name any state that's just kind of like stripping away laws one by one that have to do with, you know, protection of trans and gay kids. I bet it's pretty frightening right now. And I bet they're not really supported.
Do you see that as something that's more at the upper echelon as opposed to like day to day? Or do you think that there's some synergy between those two? Do you
know their synergy for sure? Absolutely. Trickle economics doesn't work, but trickle down culture certainly does.
So some of this and some of the music and some of the energy is about maybe pushing back against that?
Absolutely. The I think, you know, Whitey specifically, you know, we're doing a double album, and it's a full-on concept, and it's less political and a little more personal, but I think there's power in the personal too. I think classic storytelling has always really, really moved the needle more than just like screaming and preaching. I love screaming and preaching. So Whitey exists. And I think it is a pushback in general of a lot of just like culture. And my aunt actually corrected me on an interview I did recently where she was like, okay, you're going to come out swinging against cowboy Western culture. You really have to be careful and make sure people know you're not talking about Beyonce. So no, I'm not talking about Beyonce here. I actually think Cowboy Carter was a brilliant reclamation of culture that has been co-opted by people, and imagery that's been co-opted by people for the wrong reasons. Being from Northwestern New Mexico, we were raised right on the border of the Navajo Reservation. And, you know, you're talking about people who were essentially, you know, walked to Christian schools and then they slaughtered all of their parents. So like straight up genocide and then just complete like washing of culture. And the people who really did lead the way there were white cowboys, right? So you go watch the Westerns and you see all of this violence and you see all of this like cowboy and Indian. And there shouldn't be an and, it's just cowboy versus Indian, you know? And so now in culture, you're seeing a lot of people really just like don this imagery, especially white people. Like, I'm talking about the Morgan Wallens of the world and the people who are just like, yeah, cowboy culture, try that in a small town, like those folks. Like, there's nothing good about that. And then when you see like queer artists, you see that imagery start to trickle in there, you kind of want to be like, pump the brakes. Let's not do that. That's actually really not something that we need to co-opt right now. It's actually pretty bad. It's like you can kind of form a direct lineage from like cowboys to the KKK to ICE back to cowboys, you know? So for me, that's the main pushback. And then you start to think about, and so that's the first single. That was Whatever Anyway. And then the second song on the EP, Whitey, you know, you hear a lot about culture wars. And I've always had a weird kind of, like, it gives me heartburn or some sort of agita to even think about the term culture wars, because when I really think about American whiteness and I'm white, it leaves me always feeling kind of empty, because you go back and you can kind of trace everything that whiteness stands for coming from other cultures, right? And so like it's kind of this like soup, which is a great soup, but like it's strange to call that your culture and then like rail against culture in a sense. And so Whitey was our idea to kind of write a song about what whiteness really is, like white culture in America. And for me, it's more about like a system of contracts and a system of social norms and like signing these contracts to exist in this social norm. And so, yeah, this whole EP is a big pushback.
Well, that's, you know, that's been on my mind too, is this, talking about contracts, right? Because like you join, right?
Yeah.
At a certain point, you just sign up. You sign up for the you know, the kids and the house in the suburb and stuff.
Yep.
Or you sign up for college is going to get me a job as opposed to an education. And it's just, I don't know, personally for me, it's just so frustrating of like people expecting that celebrities or, you know, talk show hosts or whoever are going to have the answers to any of these questions, right?
Yeah. And I hope they wouldn't. I would hope that we're in a, I would hope, I can't say I realize we are, but I would hope that we're in a place where people could actually have a little bit of a higher level of conversation around these things. And I don't quite think it's possible right now, specifically given how like you're seeing like these massive mergers of corporations that control all media, you know, so you have this kind of terrifying realization. You know, my husband watches the Today Show, and you know, it should be quite benign, but for the past, I would say, 2 years of Biden's presidency, it was just a sea of Republican Congress people on as guests, just allowed to say whatever they wanted about Joe Biden, which, say what you want about Joe Biden, like, but that was the format. Now that we see a change to Donald Trump and all of these lawsuits, you never see any Democrat representatives on the Today Show just railing against Donald Trump. You just never see it. And their segments on it are very short. They're only allowed to say a few things. And so I just feel like the contract is in full effect and people need to start breaking the contract.
Yeah. Well, that leads me to something about, you know, obviously the band has been around for this period of time and everything like that. What has been the thing that has kept you together and kept you going? Is it this just like, oh, we've got bottomless rage?
Yeah, I think actually the language we speak together, I think musically, is a lot more, and we've always said this to each other, we love depression and sadness. We write really sad music. We just speed it up. So, you know, in every Dead Betty song, there's a really beautiful, sad song sitting somewhere underneath. But I think more than that, it's hard when you find people who do speak your language as a musician. We've all been in multiple bands. We've all been in bands that have had multiple levels of success outside of the Dead Bettys, but we always come back to each other and say like, oh, you know, we can get in a room and just do it and understand exactly where the song's moving and what to do with it. And so that's really been it. And we also, you know, we do see eye to eye. We all have pretty much similar worldviews. I mean, everyone's a different person, but you know, it at the end of the day, it's a perfect combination of, you know, how we feel in the world and just the language we speak musically.
Very, very quickly, two last questions. So I know you probably can't say too much about it, but the double album, like, what can you say about it?
So right now it's at 22 songs, which I think is the perfect number. We've written for it and recorded demos to like 57, maybe 61 songs. It's a lot more of, I always had this fantasy that, do you know the album Pretty on the Inside by Hole?
Yeah.
I always had this fantasy that there was a double album that side A was like the Celebrity Skin and side B was Pretty on the Inside. So I wanted, the original vision is to approach American outsiderism in two ways. Have the first disc, have the first record be an all out kind of celebration of the experiences of being an outsider in this country, in a way that like really like I still get like a racing heart when I watch Christine, John Carpenter's Christine, because it does feel like, you know, a true celebration of like outsiderism and like the dangerous things and things you're not supposed to do but everyone wants to do and everyone does do and they're quite fun. So the first album really just kind of a celebration, like an external celebration and an exploration and like, what is an outsider in this country? And like, what are those experiences and what does it all make? And then album two, the internalized of what does it feel like to be an outsider in the country? So really you're going to have album one, Let's Have Fun, album two, In the Dark. So Let's Have Fun in the Dark. And that's the concept we're sticking to for sure.
I just want to piggyback on the Christine thing. So when did you realize that there was such a connection between like queerness and horror?
Right. I just had a really good conversation with a friend about this. And she was like, why do all the gay men in my life love Nightmare on Elm Street? And I can't fully answer that. You know, I would have to say that I think with queer people in general, You always have this feeling growing up that like you are the embodiment of that thing that every parent is telling their kids not to be. Like whatever you do, do not do that. Like whatever happens, like just don't let it be that, and we'll work around it. We'll work with you. But if you happen to be that thing, you're bombarded with these messages of like, oh, you're never gonna have Elm Street, you know, you're never going to fit into this. You're never going to have these things, like these brilliant things that our society has constructed are not meant for you because you refuse to play by these rules. Horror for me was the first time I ever saw art being made that was like really outside of those rules. And these villains, a lot of the times, you know, the audience is rooting for Fred Krueger. You know, because he's just like, I don't like any of these preppy kids. I don't like their neighborhood. I'm going to burn it down. I'm going to haunt their kids in their sleep. And then I'm going to kill the parents, too. Like, it's just wild, but a ton of fun. And then you have movies like Candyman. Like, horror can take on so many injustices and be wildly entertaining at the same time. It's like good comedy. So I think queer people specifically feel constantly othered. And so you really... I gravitate to horror because horror is the ultimate kind of turning the mirror on the people who are othering you and being like, you're actually the monster.
I don't know what it was. Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I was watching it with a friend one night and I was like, oh my God. Yeah. Leatherface is a queer character.
Oh yeah. Texas Chainsaw is, yes, you're exactly right. I mean, but that, you just answered the question for me.
Well, and I'll close out on this because you mentioned Bikini Kill and Kathleen Hanna is aware of your band. What has that been like to like this person who obviously was instrumental in your development to be kind to you?
You know, I never in my life thought I would be kind of in the orbit of Kathleen Hanna. I got the opportunity just through, you know, the Dead Bettys toured a lot with Tammy Hart. Tammy knows Kathleen. And then I got the opportunity to engineer La Tigra's live recordings for the Bops Library at NYU. So I actually ended up engineering their live tapes from the soundboard in Kathleen's studio. And that in and of itself, I'm sweating right now thinking about that. I was like, I couldn't contain myself. I just didn't know what to do. And then Kathleen invited my husband and I to a few parties and we hung out socially. And then it turns out like she's just the nicest person and really just a gem of an activist and kind of the example we all should be. For her to be aware of my band is outrageous. And I don't quite know what else to say other than that, other than thank you. Like, that's insane. And we're not worthy, kind of like crappy Wayne's World style. But no, it's truly, it's more than an honor. It's actually something that pauses me in my steps.
You've been listening to a conversation with Joshua Ackley of The Dead Betties. That's B-E-T-T-I-E-S, not to be confused with a ska band out of Lawrence, Kansas. The group's new EP, Whitey, is out November 21st. You can learn more about this podcast and all programming on our station by visiting our website, kmuw.org. Send us your questions and comments at info@kmuw.org and find all the latest programming notes on that website as well. This is also an excellent time, as always, to remind you that our theme music is composed and performed by Torrin Anderson. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.